For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
Happy New Year, Bodhisattvas. I know it's been kind of a difficult year for many people in our planet, so I hope 2011 is a little easier. So this morning I think we'll speak with you a little bit about the Bodhisattva precepts. So a little bit of a warning that it's not my intention to make life more difficult for you. Mm-hmm. Sometimes rules are like, oh no, another rule. But nonetheless, I find them very helpful and supportive. This past year, I've rearranged my work situation so that I actually can take the Brown Line to work 2 days a week downtown at my downtown office. And every time I get to do that, I've been listening to Dharma talks. So I feel like that's like at least 2 Dharma talks per week, plus Ancient Dragon Dharma talks. So it's fun to give a Dharma talk. However, the words that I'm saying are probably totally influenced by so many other Dharma talks I've heard, so nothing I say is probably going to be too original. But I feel very grateful to so many teachers who have inspired my practice, and especially Tygon, of course, but also all the San Francisco Zen Center teachers. I know that there are people here today who have practiced at Zen Center in many forms, and I just want to express my gratitude to that deep effort. And they take no responsibility for anything I say. I take full responsibility for that today. So Friday was New Year's Eve, and we sat for several hours until midnight that evening, and also we performed a New Year's Eve ceremony. And the center, I think, of that ceremony was a renewal and reflection upon our practice with the Bodhisattva precepts. So it's kind of a nice time of year to think about whether you've been naughty or nice, and reflect upon one's actions in the world and intentions and vows. I have no doubt that each person came here today because you have some sincere wish to benefit the world. And so anything that supports that, I encourage in you. So I think most of you are probably familiar with the precepts in Soto Zen Buddhism or in Mahayana Buddhism or in some form, that they're sort of guidelines. Some of them look a little like the familiar Ten Commandments of Christianity, but they're really supports, or maybe like rails that our Dharma train runs on to help us navigate the world without causing too much trouble or suffering, right? The great project of Buddhism is liberation from suffering of some way, I guess. And I always find the precepts are a delicate thing to talk about because often it the discussion brings up a sense of guilt or shame, or I should be doing better, or I like this precept, I don't like that one. I mean, there's a lot of reactions to actually having a mirror, you could say. So the precepts might be a little mirror for us to look at ourselves. And if that happens, well, okay. But I just, you know, want to encourage you to be gentle in undertaking the precept project. You know, the precepts date back to the time of Shakyamuni Buddha, right? And actually, Buddha seemed to find them helpful because in addition to meditation and meditation practices, the practices of the precepts have been spoken about a lot by Buddha. As a matter of fact, there were volumes written in the Buddhist canon on precepts. But as Buddhism evolved over time and our school of Buddhism arose, Mahayana Buddhism, the precepts became focused on actually helping us be available to benefit others. And it seems like since Buddha's time, you know, what, 2,500 or so years ago, but even in our current time, people are concerned with ethical behavior and seem to need some rules or at least some guidelines to help. You might have heard that the former chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, Alan Greenspan, in commenting on the economic collapse we've been experiencing, said, you know, when the government deregulated the financial markets and banking, they forgot that people might actually, you know, do harm if they don't have some rules. People might get greedy and do unethical things if they don't have rules. So, you know, sometimes we need some regulation, us humans. We seem to have, you know, humans have a little difficult time restraining themselves from greed and pleasure, amongst other things. So Buddha noticed that guidelines help us live together and support our practice. And I'd like to read kind of what I think is the simplest formulation of the precepts, and one that I feel I've neglected to study in my practice. So I actually thought, oh, this year I think I'm going to study just the three pure precepts. There are many translations, but I'll kind of read Buddha's original words, or allegedly the original words. Kind of simple. Do no evil. Do what is good. Purify the mind. This is the teaching of all Buddhas. So I guess this came about when Buddha's assistant, Ananda, said, Buddha, can I ask you a question? Buddha said, okay. And Ananda said, well, what do you teach that might be different from, do you teach anything that's different from the original Buddhas before Buddha? So there's a bunch of Buddhas before Shakyamuni Buddha came along. Do you teach anything different? And Buddha said, this is what I teach. Refrain from evil. Refrain from doing harm. Cultivate the good. And purify your mind. It's the teaching of all Buddhas. So he didn't really say what he didn't have in common, but he kind of said this is a basic teaching. I have heard, this could be a rumor, but I have heard that the company code of conduct for Google says, don't be evil. They actually have that written, I think, in their guidelines. I don't know. Is there a Googler in the room? Is that true?
Yes.
Yeah, don't be evil. And I'm not quite sure what that means to the Google community, but I thought that's pretty good. You know, but like even Google has to like say, look, we've got to have some guidelines here. And they help us kind of check out how we're relating. This whole business of the three pure precepts is also written about in a fascicle by the founder of our school of Zen, Dogen Zenji, the fascicle Shōwaku Makusa. Some of you might be familiar with that. A new Shobogenzo came out. This is half of it. So it's like these thick tomes. I brought along some thick tomes today. And this is translated as refrain from unwholesome action. So Dogen starts this out saying, ancient Buddhas say, refrain from unwholesome action, do wholesome action, purify your own mind. This is the teaching of all Buddhas. And he goes on to say, this teaching has been authentically transmitted from earlier Buddhas to later Buddhas of the future, as the seven original Buddhas' general precepts in the ancestral school. Later, Buddhas received these precepts from earlier Buddhas. This teaching is not limited to the seven original Buddhas. It is the teaching of all Buddhas. Thoroughly investigate this point. So, I feel a little compelled to tell you the little story that Dogen quotes, which is kind of a famous story of Bird's Nest Roshi. Anybody hear of Bird's Nest Roshi before? Nancy? Yeah. So Bird's Nest Roshi, I mean, isn't that a great name, Bird's Nest Roshi? You know, like, it kind of, it's not like Matsu or some other famous teacher, but this guy in, you know, 9th century China lived up in a tree. So he practiced in a treehouse of sorts. Probably had to be a little bit careful, I would say, sitting zazen up in the tree. So like when you went to visit him, you'd stand at the bottom of the tree and ask him a question. Hey, Bird's Nest. So here's the little story that's kind of famous. I've not heard any real other stories about Bird's Nest. He's kind of obscure. But one person came to him named Bai Zhui. And this person, you know, is seen as sort of a humble disciple or humble seeker in this story. But this is one of, I think, the five greatest poets of Tang Dynasty China. So he was a lay person, government official, but he still found time somehow to run around and find where Bird's Nest Roshi was hanging out in a tree someplace and ask him a question. So Bai Zhuyi of the Tang Dynasty was a lay disciple of Ruman and a Dharma descendant of Matsu. When he was governor of Hang province, he studied with Zen master Daolin of Naoki. That's Bird's Nest. So one day, Zhuyi said, what is the essential meaning of Buddha Dharma? It's a common question in Buddhism, right? What's this all about? Bird's Nest. And Daolin, Bird's Nest, said, refrain from unwholesome action, do wholesome action. He didn't even bother with purify the mind. He said, start here. And Zhuyi said, if that is so, a 3-year-old child could say it. You know. And Daolin, a Bird's Nest, said back, a 3-year-old child might say this, but an 80-year-old person cannot practice this. Zhuyi bowed in gratitude and left. So that's pretty cool, I think. You know, it's sort of like Okay. That's all you need to know. And there wasn't an argument after that. And I wonder if Zhu Yi left and spent the rest of his life attempting to refrain from unwholesome action and benefit the world. I think he might have. This thing about wholesomeness is kind of interesting, you know. So the original word, I think, in Sanskrit is wholesomeness, is kushala, and it comes from this kusha grass. It's kind of a sawgrass. And there's a couple ways to think about this grass. It's a sharp grass, and to harvest it, you can easily cut yourself, so you have to be very, very careful. So there's something about being very careful, which I think is kind of nice in Zen practice. You know, like in Kinhin, we walk kind of slowly and carefully. We arrange our cushions. We arrange our seats. It's starting to help us practice to be careful. I actually, yesterday or the day before yesterday, I guess it was, I found a pin here. I don't know. I teach sewing, so I thought maybe it was my pin. I don't know where that went. I don't know. But I felt practice is kind of helpful because it allows us to see these kind of sharp objects, hopefully, before we hurt someone with them or they hurt us. And I think there's something about this carefulness of, like, how do you handle this grass? Amazingly, this grass allegedly is supposed to be excellent for, like, a zabutan, to have a mat for sitting meditation. In India, that's what people would use. So apparently the bugs have a hard time getting up through it, and it kind of insulates you. But also in picking it, you can get yourself into trouble and hurt yourself. I've also heard that this grass symbolizes cutting away delusions or unhelpful things. So that word wholesomeness comes from that root. Kind of nice thing to think about. And unwholesome, akushala, is, you know, things that cut, hurt. So that's sort of a little background on this precept. I think that it's sort of, there's a proliferation of renderings of the three pure precepts in Mahayana Buddhism. Many of you may know a lot of different ones given teachers you've studied with. But one that I've really enjoyed lately, which is Norman Fisher's translation of the three pure precepts. And Norman Fisher is a poet and a venerable Zen teacher who leads a sangha of called Everyday Zen. They have an amazing website, so I put in a plug for Norman's website. Norman was a former abbot of San Francisco Zen Center as well, but he's a very literary person, so. And he also gets to the point of practice, I think, well. So when Norman confers the Bodhisattva precepts upon the people who request them, the three pure precepts, the way he translates it is, I vow to avoid all action that creates suffering. I vow to do all action that creates true happiness. I vow to act always with others in mind. And I was especially struck by that. I think at Zen Center in San Francisco, they translate, instead of saying purify the mind, they say, I vow to live for and live with all beings. That's one way. But I think this, I vow to act with others always in mind. And I think this begins to touch what is meant by purity in Mahayana Buddhism. You know, there's a sense that purity in Buddhism means getting rid of anything that contributes to greed, hate, and delusion. extinguishing or putting out or stilling all of those kind of human habitual tendencies. But I actually, you know, I think, well, what mind are we purifying, or what is this purification business? And I think, you know, essentially in Zen practice, in Mahayana practice, we're purifying our love, our caring for the world. And what that means is an impurity is something that gets in the way of us expressing our sense of kindness and being available to others. This, I think, is a pretty humbling thing. It's not just like, oh, I just get rid of on my cushion anything that's arising that looks like greed, hate, or delusion. But this is actually noticing our habits of body, speech, and mind that cause us to hesitate when we want to be kind. It gets in the way of us being present and open with whatever is happening. And, you know, our habits and patterns and conceptual thinking about, oh, this is the way things should go, you know, get in the way. These are the usual suspects of grasping onto something or rejecting what's in our world. I think of impurity as kind of a fog that covers our seeing and being with the world, that we start to forget about the welfare of ourselves, you could say. Because actually, if you know, you really see yourself, you realize that everybody is ourself. You know, everything is ourself. So when we say, I vow to act always with others in mind, that includes ourself. In some ways, ourself is another. It also might include the welfare of bedbugs and cockroaches and chairs and dogs and cats and teacups. And how to practice with this is unique to each person, so you each find your way to purify your love, to enact the precepts. But I would like to offer some suggestions and ideas, because I think sometimes when you, if you're just sitting zazen, and that's pretty good, but it's sort of like, what are we doing when we do this? And I guess I would say that awareness helps. So first is just like being aware of what's happening inside of yourself, honestly and compassionately, and seeing through the fog. That certainly helps. But, you know, some of you might have noticed that the minute we arise from our cushions and we encounter another human organism that meets us, problems can occur. Like, we might be like, I like that person, I want more of them. Well, I don't like that, I want less of that. So immediately, you know, our human interactions are our field of practice. And even though we're in this playpen here where it's relatively safe for us to be, we're kind of still and we've got, you know, a bit of containment, and it's, you know, our practice really, you know, when it meets the pavement in the real world, there's some resistance sometimes, some difficulty. So, you know, in practicing these. So I always think these are nice things to come back to, you know. Am I thinking with others in mind? It's a good question, and probably not is my answer. You know, probably not. Others may have different experiences, but when I ask myself that question, I'm like, oops, wait a minute, I need to back up a little bit. So awareness helps for sure. I think being careful is helpful. So it's this mind of thinking that at any moment I could slip up a little bit. So it's hard to do that. You know, it's really easy in a fast-paced world, but I think it's easy in a slow-paced world to not pay attention and end up skidding into someone else. So I have a little handout to share with you. You can pass those around. That speaks a little bit of this mind of caring and the effort of the pure precepts or the effort of purification that has this sense of being careful. And I know some of you probably are familiar with the great Rinzai practitioner, Hakuin, who apparently took up calligraphy and painting at age 60. I always thought he was doing this his whole life. I guess he took it up in a serious way. There's this very famous, at the top, I Xerox. The nice thing about pen and ink drawings, calligraphy, is that it's black and white, so it Xeroxes pretty well, copies pretty well. And you can see there are these two blind men on a log, and they're crossing over a precipice on a log bridge. And the line, poem that Hakuin wrote to go along with this work is translated as caring for health and living life. All are like the blind man's round log bridge. A mind heart that can cross over is the best guide. So I think these precepts support and help us remain in touch with, to cut through that fog so that we're connected to our mind heart that crosses over with all beings. You know, we're tapping. Sangha is about us tapping together across that bridge. And sometimes, you know, might slip a little bit and give each other a hand. So I think care is quite important, being very careful. Seeing how it feels. So nobody can really say, oh, well, now you're doing good here and you're refraining from evil here. You know, we actually live in this very precarious, uncertain situation where we really can't know exactly what's going on. But the best approximation we can get is some feedback from the world. So we're tapping. I don't know if I'm tapping this wood floor, but it feels kind of solid, so I'm going to go with it for now. And then when I'm over here, it doesn't feel like I'm on solid ground. So we have to feel our way through life together. So, without getting too stuck. So, aside from being very careful and still engaging life, I think that's why some people go and hole up in a cave for 10 years all by themselves, because at some point in their practice they kind of realize that what a dangerous potential we have to get ourselves and others in trouble, to hurt the world, and they kind of need that containment. But bodhisattvas typically are living in the world like us, and so they sometimes actually, that awareness and carefulness, but also there's some intentional practices. And I think it's good, you know, it's a new year, so you can kind of pick a practice or pick something to do for the rest of the year or the rest of your life. But, you know, new year gives us time to reflect on things. So what I mean by an intentional practice is actually kind of, you know, setting an intention for yourself, like, I vow to maintain awareness of my impact on others. Or there are other things, such as this. I think this is maybe my favorite Buddhist scripture, although I probably say that about everyone I talk about. It's the Flower Ornament Sutra, the Avatamsaka Sutra. And there's a chapter in it called, interestingly enough, Purifying Practice. So it is in response to a bodhisattva chief in knowledge who asks Manjushri, the bodhisattva of wisdom, how can enlightening beings attain faultless physical, verbal, and mental action? How can they attain harmless physical, verbal, and mental action? And Manjushri says, excellent. You've asked a wonderful question because you care so much for the world. How can beings use their minds so as to attain all wonderful qualities that are helpful to others? And then there's this long recitation of things. But it said things like, when giving something, they should wish that all beings are able to relinquish everything and that their hearts are free from clinging. When gathering in crowds, bodhisattvas wish that all beings let go of attachments. If in danger and difficulty, bodhisattvas should wish that all beings go free, unhindered wherever they go. There's many of these. When washing the hands with water, they should wish that all beings have clean hands and receive and hold Buddha's teaching. When washing off the body's filth, they should wish that all beings be pure and harmonious and ultimately without defilement. When on the road, they should wish that all beings tread the pure realm of reality and their minds are without obstruction. So this just gives you an example. This goes on, I don't know, for maybe 20 pages. When seeing blossoms on trees, they should wish that all beings' features are like flowers with the wonderful marks of Buddha. So this is acting with others always in mind, that kind of thing. So that's kind of an intentional practice, these kind of purifying practices. And I think of it as sort of a wholesome habit formation. Like we have habits that might not be so good, but I think it's kind of automatically nice to think, you know, when touching a cup, I'm grateful to all beings who put forth the effort to even consider this action and hope that they are never thirsty and have clean water. So there's ways to practice. And you find your own intentional practices, right? But these are just a few suggestions, compliments of Buddha. And I hope that we can remember such things, keeping others in mind for a lifetime. And you can practice, you can write your own out if you'd like. I certainly could say a lot more, but I would like to hear your responses. So, thank you.
So one thing I particularly like about asking myself to do good and to not do evil is to figure out which is which.
Mm-hmm.
Because it doesn't say do these things because they are good. It says do good, and then your assignment is to figure that out, which seems easy, but gets sticky pretty quickly, actually figuring it out. And so it's work to do that, but it's very productive work. So someone said recently to me, oh, the way to do good is just write a check. You could do a lot of good by just writing a check and then whatever, some charity that takes care of hungry children or whatever. It seems good, right?
Yeah.
But it's pretty, I'm not saying you shouldn't do that, but it's pretty easy to then think you did good without investigating it a little more what you could do for if hungry children is something I know. Anyway, it's three small things end up being a lot more to think about than they seem on the surface. Thank you.
So say a little about the work.
Well,
what's that work?
The work is struggling because you want to just make the easy answer, and then that's pretty. You can give yourself a pass and say, okay, well, I got that one solved. But usually, if you spend a little more time, you pick up a layer and say, oh, I just adopted a cat from a cat shelter. I just set out so many things that I was thinking about how to do good and how not to do evil. So that's the way that it's the work of challenging yourself to.
Yeah, to actually, so the work is maybe that we have this impulse to get a good deed in the bank, or to figure out like, oh, okay, I can if I do my check, but then that goes into the banking system, and the banking system creates this, and, I buy this kitten, and my other cat doesn't like it, and, So there is something, there was a quote that says, if you engage the world, if you pick up a speck of dust, you get involved with the suffering of the entire world. So this is that without hesitation. And you feel your way, and you're right. Like, you can go and you can analyze everything to death, but we don't know. Even the most harmless thing can seem horrible, and then the most horrible thing might be okay. And so struggling with that kind of uncertainty freaks us out. It's like we want to know, and we want to get that little credit in the bank. Usually, we don't want to get in the debit. We don't want to get that extra fee for doing evil. So it's a great point you bring up. And that struggle is like, how do you relax with situations? And also, I think, get in touch with what you really, really feel deep inside. Norman says, I do all action that creates true happiness. I think when we get confident in our true heart, we know what that is. And still we have to, by knowing it, we have to be open to not ever being able to know it. It's a really wonderful and difficult practice because we want to know. Nancy? Song.
Thank you for a wonderful talk, and I was just thinking along those lines, not so far from what has already been said. I think about times when I have an impulse to give something to someone, and the person I'm receiving, and that's not what they wanted or needed at all, it turns out. And it's sometimes I have to be open to receiving feedback about that. But also, sometimes it's not always so clear either, because like as a parent with a child, they don't want to clean up after dinner and go to their room and, go to bed, but, and there could be some feedback, but no, that's not what I want, that's not what I need. But Just like you're saying, having to be open to, you know, what's really happening, and as if that were really one thing, you know, that there can be multiple perspectives mm-hmm. to that and multiple dimensions.
And I think that impulse to give is good. You know, of course, tangled up in our goodness is our ancient twisted karma of I actually want to give somebody something I want sometimes, you know. Sometimes that's the case. Sometimes it's still okay. They still enjoyed the gift, or they didn't, and I have to be like, oh, I was off base.
It really makes me think about, you know, the concept of faith and how you mm-hmm. just have to have faith that you might even be making a mistake,
yeah.
you know, that the world will then respond and help you see that.
Yeah, it's actually the whole world is helping you make that mistake and supporting you in it. I think you had something right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It seems like there's a bit of a tension between what I hear being said as far as being aware, looking at, you know, what's the right thing to do in the situation, and kind of what I heard as far as more intentional action mm-hmm. of, you know, when I'm walking on a path, mm-hmm. I will be wishing that all beings may, you know, travel a path mm-hmm. of reality. And I know people who are very good at every action, they've got their little, you know, I shouldn't say mantra.
Right, Gatha saying, yeah.
But, you know, they've got mm-hmm. their little sayings and they've got their way of doing it. And it seems like every time I come up with a way of doing something, that's the right way to do it, except when it isn't. And there's always that other side. And so how do we bring that intentionality while also being open to what the minute is actually mm-hmm. calling for, and that sort of freedom and lightness that I find with the true masters.
And I think you answered your question, right? There's sort of lightness. How do you get there? Probably, you know, like you're kind of saying, oh, I just am imposing my gatha. Like, I feel so good about, like, wishing all beings well that I just, like, you know, forgot that I ignored half the beings in the room, you know, or I, like, you know, I wanted to feel like I'm really doing this practice, so, like, you know, I just, like, hit somebody in the face or something, you know, I mean, this happens, and so the willingness to give that up, you know, you can be like, oh, I'll put that down right now, and, like, oh, okay, I need to answer the phone or talk to my daughter or feed my cat or, you know, somebody doesn't want me in their space, so that gatha feels, or that wish feels intrusive. So that backing off and adjusting. But it's that lightness and openness you feel, probably, like I think with someone like Shohaku, right, who's, they adjust. You know, I've seen this very much in Japanese practitioners, often adjusting to the situation. And Americans, I think, sometimes culturally, we have a little hard time sometimes adjusting to situations. We want to make our mark. But there's something very sweet about adjusting to situations. Our forms help us with this. So this is the first time certain people are doing some of the jobs today for this retreat. We're having a half-day retreat. And so, you know, Will is helping me offer incense. And, you know, there's a way that we're communicating, you know, that Dawn and I communicate, that we all communicate with each other around making this happen. And so we practice that together. And I think only by practice, you know, someone like Shohaku has practiced a lot and probably has practiced with his wife and family bring up stuff that, you know, have helped polish him, you know. So, but it's... keep going, I think would be the word. So thank you.
Yeah, yes, just Michael. Thinking of the three precepts, and you know, most people know the saying in the Bible of mm-hmm. love your neighbor as yourself. So mm-hmm. this is kind of a positive approach mm-hmm. that we consider to be good. And yet there's commentaries that I'm aware of, and then these precepts that begin with don't do evil, do good.
Mm-hmm.
So the notion is that maybe the wisdom lies in the pure mind in refraining from doing before doing. It's interesting that perhaps the wise action first is no action, then proceed to action.
Have you experienced that, like in your time at Green Gulch, maybe?
No, I wouldn't say so much. Well, just in my life, you know, yeah, around a few years, not that many, enough, and recognizing that certain behavior that I can consider justified based on circumstances turns out to be unproductive. So it may not be a bad practice to consider the first action non-action, or the first word non-word.
Yes, I think
just
that's
as a practice.
Absolutely, I think that's one of the things that I'm aware of at times that I've experienced is that people who speak more slowly in our culture or act more slowly are considered stupid, and people are put off by that often, or find it, you know, real aloof. Like, I remember going to Zen centers and people are kind of slow and, you know, hesitate, and you're like, "What's up, man? You know, just let's get the show on the road." And there's something that's very supportive in that, not refraining, because that gives you the second before you're doing something to kind of go, "Oh, am I giving because I want to get something?" Or did I find out? Did I really find out what's helpful from this person in this interaction? And we can't know it, but I think that hesitation is very wise. So thank you very much for that. Come.
Oh, God. Well, I just wanted to go off that because that reminded me about what. So then, when you talk about the fast-paced world, and maybe not having that time to make that, you know, that, oh, wait a minute, you know, because things are going too fast. So then what?
Stop.
So, because I guess that's what I think about, because, you know, I pay attention, and I remember my first time going to a Zen center and just being like, oh my God. Spit it out already, or drink your water, you know, like drink the water. And but now I'm realizing that was intentional, like, oh, I get it now. And I've slowed down because I remember that reading with children and stuff, it's better to enunciate and read slowly and all that stuff. So, but now, for a different reason, I'm learning these things. But then when I'm out and about, like on the street, things are happening so fast, or on the bus, you know, it's just so quick, and I'm so quick, and it's still hard to, like, slow it down.
When you're in a momentum.
Yeah. To do, you know, the, wait, is that right? Or wrong? Or what? And to be able to take that moment. And so I guess I just wanted to say that because I had it in my head. And I appreciate that.
You know, and also there is that unhesitating response. You know, I think practice bodhisattvas can move kind of quickly and seem like they're moving slowly. You know, but this is sort of lifetime of practice maybe. But, you know, there's something that I would suggest is investigate what makes it hard to slow down. Because there is a sense of this contagion when everybody's kind of, you know, moving quickly. But I've noticed that actually if you don't do that, if you stop and say hello to the bus driver and put your thing in, something happens. Like, you start to invite an intimacy and an interaction.
Oh, yeah, I always say hi to the bus driver.
Yeah.
It's important.
So maybe you slow down more than you realize.
Maybe.
But I think it's always good to know when we're not. You know. But it is, you know, we also have to kind of live in the world, but there is, I think, a lot more room for consideration.
I was thinking about what you were saying and intention, and then what Laurel had commented on, and And sometimes I think that intention actually gets in, it, not that it gets in the way. It's good to have good intentions, but I feel because life is so busy, mm-hmm. I feel like I'm running to catch up and I never catch up. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I think it is good to just write the check and leave the intention there and then try to be in the moment, because it's so hard to, it's hard to catch up. And I like feeling like I'm doing the right thing, but sometimes, almost every single time, plans are just plans, and that's not how it goes. It just, it, everything, you know, is very different in real time. So, this holiday and this winter, I've been noticing that, like, when it comes to charitable contributions, that I'm like, well, you know, I only have this much time, and I actually feel like I just want to write a check and stay in real time with my actions and not feel like I'm running all the time to, you know, to catch up with what I intended to do.
Yes, I think bodhisattvas write checks sometimes. Yeah. Sometimes they go, maybe I'm not going to write a check today.
Right. Yeah, not that I'm not like, you know, money bags, but it's...
Yeah.
I'm just kind of relating that to, you know, the amount of, you know, time of the day.
Yes.
Everything actually looks a lot differently than how I would like it to be. So.
Right. And it's important to take care of yourself too, you know, to be kind and say, wow, not all intentions are fulfilled in every way, but maybe they're all fulfilled with your sweetheart.
Yeah.
I just had a brief comment about the meaning of intention. Mm-hmm. So I feel like you guys are using the word intention in a way differently than I tend to use it in this context. But for me, intention, it's not a plan, and it's not, it's not a plan.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it's a certain kind of energy,
mm-hmm.
that you have,
yes.
in the situation.
Yes.
So when you set your intention, it doesn't mean like formulating a plan.
Yes.
It means kind of focusing your energy in a certain way. And what actually happens is different, but, you know, setting your intention is bringing a certain kind of emotion and energy to the situation.
That's right. I think that's really helpful. So it's not like I've got to impose my intention on the world. So maybe that's a little bit of a answer to Roy's question, that working from an intention that isn't a plan trying to control things, but this energy of openness and flexibility, and how to find that. It's advanced, but important. Kathy, were you having a comment?
Yeah, I mean, all this kind of fits together in my mind, but I just got an email from a friend of mine who moved to New Orleans, he and his wife, a couple years ago, and he was my yoga teacher for a number of years, and his intention, or she has cancer, and so his intention is to be able to be content with whatever happens in his life. And I was thinking, in that, you know, I can relate to that, and to be in the last year more present.
Mm-hmm.
But I was also thinking about this in other ways, like when you're talking about how to give and whether to give something in terms of money, or I heard some commentary recently that we as Americans don't knock on our neighbor's door anymore.
Hmm.
We're pretty tunneled or siloed in terms of knowing the people around us. And I miss that. I grew up in a much more neighborly community. But I have adopted that. And I think that the issue of slowing down has a lot to do with it. because I just notice how people respond to me sometimes when I'm going to work and I'm late and so I'm rushing by and I can rush onto the elevator and rush off and not really notice if somebody's needing a hello or a hold the door or whatever. And I notice those are the times when I can be, I know I seem, can be brash or something sometimes. And, but slowing down, so that means I cannot always be running my life at the last minute.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which means that I'm always in a rush and my rush is the most important thing. So this slowing down allows me to be more present with what's going on around me, which kind of reminds me of what Nathan was saying, but it also reminds me of his blind men with their...
Sure.
You know, it's like you, to feel your way, you have to be slowed down enough mm-hmm. to be able to be present.
Yes, that's a great example. I like the people who like, and I may have actually done this myself in my life, I'll confess, pushing the elevator door to close when they see people coming so they can like close the door really fast. You know? And there is this sense of, you know, it's okay. You're actually going to get to your place 30 seconds later, probably. Or like in traffic, you know, when people are like cutting you off and you end up at the same stoplight for miles, you know? And so there's something like that mind is exactly, it's a mind that investigates and is open and is a little tentative. You know, back to what I think Michael was saying, that tentativeness. Scott.
You know, all these comments and what we've been talking about, I never really looked at it like this, but I have family that's out in Tennessee, and there's not really anybody left in Kentucky, but we used to go out there for family vacations, and when I started getting older, I started really looking at how people do move a lot slower out there, where me and my sister are in the car, cutting people off, you know, wondering why everybody's driving so slow, like we're used to driving around here. And when you're driving down a road where you don't see any houses, and then you see a house and there's some people out there and they're waving to you, and you're wondering, what are they waving at? It's kind of creepy at the time, because I'm just not used to it at all. And then when you're going into a store, they're taking forever to get in there, and I just didn't like it. I'm not used to it. But looking at it now, just thinking about that, I should take another trip out there and see my family and really use that as a practice to look at. I can learn from them. I mean, they're very calm and patient and caring. Like, yeah. I was something we never really do out around here, or I mean, some areas are dangerous and spots, but I mean, I was with my aunt, and we're on a street on the highway just driving down, and we're waiting for the rest of our family who was behind us. So she pulls on the side of the highway, and we're just sitting there waiting. She has her hazards on and this and that. And there's cars coming up, pulling over to see if we need any help, and just, you know, what's wrong? Can we do anything for you? And I'm thinking, like, lock the doors. Don't let that happen. But it's just, I mean, they're just more, I mean, compassion, naturally, than what we're adjusted to out here in this fast-paced world. And it's just, I don't know, I really want to go back out there and see my cousins now a little bit more, just thinking about this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. That sense of community is so important. And it's one thing I think that American Zen is still challenged by and is making an effort towards, is having that sense of community. You know, the Japanese priests are members and serve the temples for generations, serve the community, and are a place of refuge for the community, and actually inquire, how are you doing? You know, I think that's good for us to remember as young Americans. Well, these are a rich topic, and I want to thank everyone for your wonderful engagement of the Dharma and sharing this with me. But we need to get the show on the road.